Hi, good evening, everybody. Good evening, you online Sangha also. Good evening. So we're continuing to work with our theme for Ango, the verse Faith in Mind. As I think about this verse and the Ango period, I was kind of struck by the process that we're all kind of find our way. You know, we all kind of find our way together. We're all kind of working at that, both in specifically with this particular poem, but also in general. I mean, I think we're all here to try to find our way together. Well, on a journey of discovery, you know. You know, one of the things that I was saying in the first talk that I gave was that in this poem, first of all, it is thought to be from the 6th century. Although some scholars think it might have been written later than that. Some scholars also think that maybe even the story of the patriarch and his life might have been slightly different than what has been written down. Even the question of who really wrote it. Although in several of the books of biography of the ancient teachers, they all speak about the third patriarch being a layperson, of having a lot of illness, as I mentioned some time ago, even leprosy, and that he was a wandering monk, like a lot of the monks were at the time. As I was saying, the first talk, probably we call him homeless now. And he was a layperson as well. So some people say that this has been exaggerated and it's different, and, you know, but I didn't care. I was thinking that even if that was the case, I think we learned from even the mythology, even if it's mythology. What's more important about mythology is that mythology wants to take you to some deeper place. You know, the function of mythology is to wake us up to some other sense of who we are. And if the story and the narrative helps us to do that, then so be it. Who cares what the actual fact is of whether it was from the 6th century or the 7th? But the narrative story and the mythology is beautiful. It's a great teaching. As I say, you know, the mythology takes us deeper into what it means to be human, what it means to live an authentic life, seeing how we're more than we think we are, you know, helps us look at aspects of ourselves that we don't usually recognize, you know. Although we really haven't explored this poem in the past here at the Empty Bowl, it's a very revered poem in Zen tradition, in Zen literature. Why? You might be asking. Because I think it paints a beautiful picture of the play between oneness and the interconnectedness of things and the duality of things. The phenomenal world of things and the interconnectedness, the deeper exploration of the oneness that sits behind it. The poem speaks to this all through, all through. It speaks to, I think it's about 32 pairs of opposites if you go through this poem and look at all the opposites that are expressed in it. And yet, the sense of oneness is also the thread that runs through them all. You know, Saint-Saëns is constantly saying through the poem, don't get caught in the world of opposites. The world of opposites are there. Don't get caught in them. So I wanted to read one little aspect of this. This is toward the end of the verse, end of the poem, which I think is beautiful. He writes, "For the unified mind is always in accord with the way. All self-centered striving ceases. Doubt and irresolutions vanish. And life in true faith is possible. With a single stroke, we are freed from bondage. Nothing clings to us as we hold on to nothing. All is empty, clear, self-illuminating, with no exertion of the mind's power. No exertion needed. Here, thoughts, feelings, knowledge, imagination are of no value. In this world of suchness, there is neither self nor other than self." So, when I was sitting with this, what came up to me was the question of, well, what is the truth anyway? He speaks about questioning truth. You know, what is the truth? And we even chanted it this evening, you know, truth is not a thing. Truth is not a thing. So I vow to enter this Dharma entrance gate. So as I sat with this, what came up for me was that our practice was a practice of hanging out with uncertainty, that we can't know what the truth is. There is no, you want to know the truth? You can't handle the truth. You can't know what the truth is. The truth is not a thing that you can know. It's an experience. And I think that discovering what that means is to be able to sit with uncertainty, because as soon as our third patriarch says, you try to grab onto something, you've lost it. You're caught. But when we sit in Zazen, we're practicing sitting with the fact of uncertainty, that we really don't know, that life is fleeting, that it's a river, that it's moving all the time, and so are we. So we hang out with uncertainty, try to ground ourselves and be open to uncertainty, possibility. Now, this is hard to do. I don't know about you. It's hard to do for me. I want to know. I have always wanted to know. There's a part of me that has always wanted to get it right, to have the answer, to have things clear, to have things certain, whatever that means. When I was sitting with this too, you know, sometimes when I'm sitting with, so I'm putting a talk together, you know, I'm sitting with the verse or sitting with what I want to say, and sometimes I don't know what I want to say, and what I want to say just comes up because I'm open to something coming up, you know, and it will arrive, kind of like when you're writing, I suppose, kind of like sometimes when you're writing a poem or a song. And one of the things that came up for me was a memory that I had really forgotten about that speaks to this. When I was really starting in Zen practice, I went to see Roshi. I went to Doksan, Daisan, Doksan. And I really wanted to say to him, you know, what's this all about? I want to know. I want to know. I want to know. Please tell me what this is all about. And he remained silent. I didn't understand why he would remain silent. I said, maybe he doesn't know. Maybe I should find a different teacher who does know. I didn't understand that the silence was a response. He was telling me, he was showing me, he wasn't telling me, obviously, he was showing me how to do it. He was showing me, telling me in his own silence that you can't possibly lock down truth. You can only stay open-hearted and silent and not know, because truth is a flowing river. So one of the things that I found when I went looking for my little notes, because when I was first studying in Zen, I had a diary, you know, I had to write it down because I had to know. So when I would discover something or heard something that resonated with me, what did I do? I wrote it down so I would know. Then I'd have it always. And if somebody would ask me, I could tell them because I'd know. But as I wrote these things down, I had some interesting things come up. There were a few questions. One of them I wrote after I started to understand how to stay open in the flow of life that was always changing instead of locking in. I wrote, well, the first thing I wrote is, well, Toto, we're not in Kansas anymore. I mean, something all very new opened up, you know. The second thing I wrote was, where does water meet the sky? You see, it was a question that helped me stay open. Open. Where does water meet the sky? Where does water meet the sky? Can you answer that? Can you give me something with certainty? No. Can you hold the question like a poem and let something open up? Where does water meet the sky? And then I wrote another question. This is remarkable. I don't know. I wish I had written the date. Where does water meet the sky? When does sound become a song? When is the moment that sounds turn into a song? Remarkable. How does that happen? How could you know? What makes a bird decide to fly? I blew myself away with these questions. I mean, I was just, you understand? You understand what I'm trying to say here about to being open to this life, to being open to uncertainty in this life, which I think is what the patriarch is trying to teach us. That you are not going to be able to connect to the thread of that oneness that we live in and live as if you keep grabbing on to the having to know it, which are always is the world of opposites, always the world of duality, has and has not, does and does not, is and is not. Just like any koan, the koans ask us this. The koans are always trying to get us to pull the rug out from under our knowledge base so we can open up to something more grand, something more spacious, something more beautiful, something more alive, who we are. What makes a bird decide to fly? How could you know? Can you hang out with not knowing? When does the feeling of love arrive? When does the feeling of love arise? So As I remembered these things, and I went to my little old journal, it was all ripped and broken, you know, it became clear to me, again, in this way, what this part of the poem is trying to say, and I think what Third Patriarch is trying to say. And then I thought maybe that's why we're all here, that I think I left an attempted practice in my Catholicism, because they were pushing a lot of truths. You know, they were pushing a lot of truth with a capital T truth, and I didn't buy it. Small T truths, okay, but not big T truths. You know, and it was part of what I think brought me here, and maybe part of what has brought you folks here as well, to a practice that really is not interested in literal knowledge and in scriptures and in following a particular belief system. Zen abhors a belief system. It asks you to learn something from experience, from being in your body, from feeling things, not from a knowledge base of concepts that you can then adhere to and hold to. It'll constantly try to knock that out of us. It wants to know what it means for you to be a human being and what it means for us to be alive in this world. And that's what brought me, I think, one aspect that brought me to Zen practice, because I couldn't hang out with capital T truths. I had to find out for myself, you know, usually by bumping into one wall after another. You know. Because our practice is always asking us in a variety of ways to find some truth beyond a belief, to find some truth beyond a word or an idea, to always challenge that, beyond a particular line, beyond an object, you know. It says instead, sit down, shut up, open your heart and open your mind and be with things as they actually are and see what opens up for you. Follow that, not a scripture. Find out what unfolds in your heart. Find out what your story is. Find out what you get caught in believing. Find out how your body works. Find out where intuition and love come from. Find out how we create our own stories about how to live. Find out. Nobody's going to tell you. Roshi was silent. What a beautiful teaching. He wasn't going to give me his idea. How beautiful is that, to withhold information so I could find it myself? You know, he could have given me his answer, but he would have stolen something from me, right? He would have stolen from me the possibility of my discovery of my own song, you know. So we notice, and we notice again. We acknowledge, and every time we sit down, we open up to something fresh and new. I was telling Toni before, because I was asking her to do the altar, to show her how to do it, and the one thing I said was is that why we refresh the water every single time is because the mind is refreshed all the time. The water changes every time we come to sit here. We refresh it. Just like the mind is refreshed, that's what the teaching of the water on the altar is about. So then I ask myself, this is what I learned. Okay, Ray, so you have all these words, but put it into one word. Can you put it into one word? Can you say it in one word? Can you make it concise? And I would use the word intimacy. If I had to bring everything that in this poem to one word, I would call it intimacy. And that's what I think the third patriarch is asking us to explore, intimacy with our life that nobody else can possibly give you. Call it love. Intimacy. Zen doesn't call it love. I don't know why they don't call it love. They call it intimacy. Call it love. Call it intimacy. Call it oneness. Call it interconnection. But that's what he's asking us. That's what the poem is asking us to discover. Throughout all of these opposites in our life, there's a thread of love and intimacy that runs through them all. And that's what he's asking us to discover. So, as I was saying, I think a few weeks ago, let's open this up a little bit. We have a few minutes. Thoughts, your insights into the poem for yourself, what you're discovering or not. How are you finding this? Anything that you're discovering in this poem? So we'll go with the in-person Sangha first, and then if there's anyone online. Any questions, thoughts, insights, discoveries? Yeah, James.
When I sit with the verses, one thing I notice is that even a single word is an opportunity to lose that unified spacious awareness, even a single word. Mm-hmm. And you see that single word is duality, mm-hmm. even one word, because it's a word that has no substance.
Yeah.
It's something that by consensus all humanity agrees yeah. is a tree, and it's not actually
right.
The consciousness, the awareness that is a tree, and something different. It's a word.
That's right.
And that duality, in even a single word, and I think that's part of what the late in the verses it starts getting into, is even that single word that arises, we can get lost in.
Right.
And I lost so much more than that, but even that is, we have to let go of it.
Yes, not to get lost. I mean, you have to speak, right? I mean, you have to say something. You have to use words, but it's not to get lost in the word. It's not to think that the word is the thing, right? The word is not the thing.
I have no attachment to the
yeah.
any words.
Yeah.
At all.
Yeah. That's good. Yeah. Thank you. Anyone else here? No. I hope you're reading the poem and hanging out with it. It's a beautiful. Anyone online? Thought, question, insight, discovery? Okay. I hope you all online are also hanging out with the poem and exploring it, even if you find one line that speaks to you that you can take with you. Yeah.
What you were saying about how this boils down to intimacy, it yeah. brings to mind koan, not knowing.
Yes,
most
intimate.
Not knowing means not attaching.
Not attaching.
Words to thoughts and concepts and just being with words. Being.
Yeah, that's really good. Yeah. And then, of course, you know, it's why we practice, because it's very hard to do that. We have the tendency to want to know. We have the tendency to want to strive, to get, to gain, to, you know. It's built in us, I think. And it has its purpose, it has its function, but not if you want a spiritual practice. Yeah, James.
This is really, for me, brought to light this weirdness about practice, which is it takes effort. It takes effort to sit down and be still mm-hmm. and keep coming back to awareness, to stillness yeah. as best we can. But so there's an effort, but there's no goal. I mean, it says in the verses, I think it's effortless or something like that.
Right.
But there really is no, like, intimacy arises, we let go, but we're not, okay, now I'm gonna disattach. Now I'm going to be intimate. Now I'm, none of that operates.
Right.
One is either in intimacy, in disattachment, or one isn't. But it is And the effort is just sitting there and observing and seeing what arises. But it does come when we sit there consistently and with effort.
Yeah, that's right. That's what makes it so hard to sit, because you're not doing anything. You're just being, all of a sudden, dropping into being. So you have to be an explorer. I mean, you really decide you have to be an explorer to say, I want to explore consciousness, awareness, awakeness. You know, it's an adventure, really. You know. Anyone else? Yeah, Tony, please.
I spoke back weeks ago on the line, when love and hate are both absent, everything is clear in the skies. And I love this poem. I use it out loud many times in the book before. It's just my favorite, so I can't believe we're doing it.
It's good.
And that one I never paid much attention to it. And then the Sangha member, Ruth, asked a question about it.
Ruth, yes, she's here.
Oh, Ruth, thank you. Your question, right on right in the training. And I talked to Sensei about this, because it's like, I've always known how to deal with hate. Because I've been in the social work field, and so of course you have hate, but then you learn how to let it go and act so that you can help. Mm-hmm. But love is, you had mentioned how like it's such a human thing, and it causes a lot of trouble sometimes.
Yeah.
And I've never really learned how to deal with love like the same way as hate. And then I wondered, is love really the greatest thing, or is it, now I'm thinking, is it really intimacy? Love and hate are so full of our emotions and opinions. Is intimacy maybe the greatest thing? Just knowing? Am I making any sense?
Yeah, well, it makes sense to me in the sense that I think, you know, love is such a trap word. You know, everybody, you know, songs about love. What's love? Love is this, love is that. Everybody throws around love, 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 love. Who knows what love is? But intimacy is different. For me, that the word intimacy takes away all of the constructions that have been built around love. You know, intimacy means is as close as the air that we breathe. You know, it's right there. You know, and it takes away all of that, those old attachments to what love is. You know, that's I don't know if that speaks to what you're saying.
Yes,
but,
because you know, I grew up in Catholic Church and then Protestant Church. They always say love is the greatest thing, and the greatest thing is love.
Well, it's an easy idea.
Right.
It's an easy idea. It's why I was trying to say before that the third patriarch, Sengsan, was a layman. He struggled. The poem that comes out of him is born from suffering. It's born from the discovery that comes out of his suffering. It wasn't an easy idea that he read in a book. It wasn't something that he heard in church. It wasn't an easy concept that he got in a greeting card. Love is the greatest, you know. It was born out of sweat and difficulty, you know. And that's, I think, where true love comes out of it. It really does, you know. Yeah, James.
When I hear the word love, that I think of love as a verb with an object. You love something.
Yeah.
Some person.
Yeah.
Something. But it's that duality again.
Right.
The way we typically think of love is, there's the love for the object of my love or desire, and that is illusion. That's exactly what the poem is talking about. There was something in where did I see this? It might have been in my Zen calendar, and I can't remember who said it, but it's, we cannot love someone. We can be in love, but we cannot love someone. So love is like a state of being where we have awareness and space for others.
Yeah, Ram Dass called it isness. It is isness. Is it just is?
Ray.
Yes.
It's me, Rana, in California. I want to say something about this talk about love. I'm going to tell you this. when I touch an open heart right here, I'm in love. I can't help myself, Ray. Mm-hmm. When I let go, whatever, if I'm with somebody and I just let go of something, mm-hmm. my heart opens up and I am in love, Ray. Now, I know that's a hackneyed word, but I am. Mm-hmm. I don't understand that. It's
that's probably really good. love is not a greeting card. You know, it's an experience. It's something that you actually feel in your body and in your heart.
Yeah.
It's an experience. You know, a swelling of life, it seems to me.
Yeah.
An opening that happens beyond the borders of our body. I mean, it just extends out.
As soon as there's no clinging.
Right.
In that tiny, tiny little moment, there's no clinging.
Right.
Everything opens.
There it is. Thank you, Rona.
Thanks, Rona. That's cool.
You're welcome.
All right. Let's keep exploring. Thank you.